Hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope everybody's doing great. This is our last of our four seminars in about 59 minutes. You'll know absolutely as much as I do. I hope this has been helpful. I want to answer a couple of questions that I've received, and I want to open it up for other discussion and questions before we move into our material. One of the questions was, would you mind providing an example using your neural conditioning work page? It would be helpful in applying it. Let me give you the example of when I developed that. I was working with a woman who was an executive, very accomplished professional, who was having difficulty in her life when she went home to her family, her parents and siblings, for a major holiday, for like a Thanksgiving or Christmas. And this otherwise, may I ask for a mute, a star six for background noise like paper rustling? If you would mute until you're ready to speak, it would be very helpful. Thank you. I'd like to keep an open line. Appreciate it. She functioned in a very, very high capacity nationally until she went home and she kind of lost it. She had managed to be able to, she'd had therapy and all kind of stuff to deal with it before she started working with me. She could manage it about a day and a half maybe, but then she would just kind of lose it. Her resilience would go, and then she would, you know, be in fights and just, you know, be set off. And what I had her do, because I heard the state change, that as soon as she got triggered in certain ways, that she would instantly change her state of mind. And I asked her when she did that, when she responded in the ways that she described, what was the age of that conversation? In other words, how old did she feel inside? She said, well, that's fascinating. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm 14, and sometimes I feel like I'm 6, which was very different than the 45-year-old, very accomplished executive. So I explained that I think that it would be helpful if she could really understand the cues or the triggers for that state change and look at sort of reprogramming how she could respond and plan to respond. So I had to draw basically that. Could I still get a mute, please, star six? I'd like to not have to go to lecture mode here. Ask her to draw three vertical columns and put the label at the top, essentially what you guys have, to schedule an appointment with herself, a brainstorming session with herself for about 30 minutes, and write down all the cues or the triggers that she was aware of in the context of her family, and to look then at writing what was her immediate response, her reaction to each. And as she began to do it, she noticed that there were a number, which I suspected. And I had her do that so that she could reflect on this without going there, without having the state change itself. Because once you're in a state, you can't really work with or understand or reason your way out of it. You have to get centered and grounded and then go into a different state. It's a two-step process. So I had her do those two. And then at a different time, I had her schedule another appointment with herself and write down how she would like to get centered and grounded, and I used the example of a mantra, which we talked about, and there's a copy of that on my blog. It's like the second or third down in the archive blog under mantra, and develop her own in a way that she could get grounded and centered repeatedly and quickly. And then to write out what her ideal response, her ideal behavior was to each of those cues, so that across from left to right, she had her usual cue. She coded her radar for early recognition so that she could immediately be aware of the cue and the state change so that she could then get grounded and move into her ideal response. And it took her until the end of the second major holiday before it became automatic and she didn't have this instant change anymore. So the idea of writing it down and doing it and repeatedly doing the mantra and getting centered again and again is to reprogram that cue that's a trigger emotionally that triggers a different state to have a different meaning and to have a different behavior then so that you automatically can reframe that and use it in a different way. And she found that immensely successful. And I've sort of played with it and revised it just a little bit since then, and refined it. But that's the essence of the one that we've used. And I've used it in a handful of instances, with clients. I don't use it with everyone, but, the next I used was with a CEO who was having a really difficult time in a negotiation with another CEO, and I had him use it because he was getting into reactive modes, and he found a way to use that to, you know, to create a different scenario of response. So does that make sense now in terms of applying it to any kind of emotional cue or trigger that can be state changing and cause somebody to be upset or even change into a different kind of mindset? Like I heard someone describe, we discussed this in one of the trainings I do, the New Money Story Mentor Training, about one of the trainees talked about, she gave me permission to use this. She said she was immensely successful herself, but then she said, every once in a while, I feel like an imposter. I feel like, you know, that you know, how can I do it? How can I pull this off? And then we looked at the same scenario. What was the age of that comment? Well, I feel like I'm 16. And I said, what then cues or triggers? And then she was able to look at that and do some, I asked, may I coach you for a moment? And then she gave me permission, and then gave me permission to use the example. To remain in a confident state of mind and to sustain that through whatever cues might otherwise derail her. So confident is a state of mind. We're really talking about states of mind here. And it's especially important in transitions where people are, you know, giving up a whole context of what they do and what supports them. Think about somebody who's been an executive with the same company for 36 years, and suddenly they make a change and a transition. They're on their own. They start their own consulting or their own coaching business, and they don't have all that support anymore. They're going to need to create and sustain a state that's confident and will respond optimally to different situations. Any thoughts or questions about that? That example or the use of that chart?
I have a question.
Yes, please. This is...
Hi, Dave. It's Jamie.
Okay. Hey, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you? Nice to be on the call live.
Hey, yeah.
I love the chart, and I have used it, and I'm curious, since I know you recommend that we do the two stages, the left side and the right side of the chart, at two different times. But if we share the chart with someone out of the gate, is it detrimental for them to kind of work linearly from left to right if they're thinking about it or trying to brainstorm about how they'd like this to unfold using it?
You know, that can work. It's just sometimes that somebody has such a charged content that they need to schedule a way to focus just on the response without getting into the response and into the state. And sometimes just having it delimited like that can do that. But no, if somebody can go all the way across, all the better.
Okay. And I just, this is related to that. Do you think it's necessary for people to have some kind of mindful practice, let me phrase that differently. This is effective whether somebody may be interested and or meditating or understanding breathing techniques, or this essentially is a technique recognized neurally anyway that works without those other practices, although they could be beneficial. Is that correct?
Absolutely agree with everything you said.
Okay.
I think using mentalization and coaching, which is the ability to reflect on our thinking, mindfulness, to be able to really create a state of being grounded and centered, I think all of those can be very, very beneficial. There's been some really good research about how beneficial meditation can be for enhancing the immune response as well as insight and understanding. So I think all the things that you mentioned can be something that we can practice and that we can, you know, foster in the process of what we're doing without making it something officially that somebody does
coaching. And if they're not interested, though, the technique that you're sharing with us in the chart would still be effective, essentially, yes?
Right. But also, in thinking about mindfulness, as we're empathically resonating with someone, we're helping them to resonate with themselves and develop their own empathy. So in the process of doing this, we're going to be able to facilitate this with clients without officially calling it something, without, taking time out to say, okay, we're going to do a little mentalization now. We're going to do a little mindfulness. We're going to do we by knowing this can incorporate it and synthesize it and integrate it in what we do and create a significant benefit for our clients, as you know and as I think you do by the question you ask.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Super. Any other comments or questions before we get started? Okay, well, I'm going to save some time at the end for discussion, so be ready with any questions then. I want to talk in our final seminar about some specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And start out with an example of a transition niche coaching. Practicing professionals like healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purposes of purchasing their expertise, and their expertise to solve problems and give specific advice is backed by professional standards and substantiated by laws or codes. Now, even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, these professionals have probably not been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle to their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional advancement, and to convert from work ethic to performance ethic. So emotionally and strategically, they have not specifically engaged in managing career transitions. They've assumed they would do one thing, the profession they've trained for, all their lives. Now, another, and I'm just giving some examples just to stimulate your thinking about the applications here of what we've been talking about to different niches of coaching. Another genre, performance professionals, actors and professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success, especially retirement transition for pro athletes. Now, here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths, the points or the play immediately following a tense and hotly contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser, on both sides, these intense encounters tend to be in a weakened aftermath. The winner is excited about the victory. This carries over into affecting the next play. The loser is frustrated by what also carries over into errors or trying too hard. So the aftermath point and the plays are likely to be lost in errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively and with full concentration. Think about the application here for any wins and losses, especially big wins and big losses that people have. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, but tomorrow is the next day. Your next career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything that you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone, on its own. And again, think about the applications here for whatever change and transition you may be focused on. Divorce, retirement, career change, loss of a partner. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of a transitions of a transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and often abrupt loss, like a job loss, significant relationship, disability, or divorce. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. Then this task becomes important as it affects other components of a situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management creates challenges such as making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of the divorce and not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People stay in one place, in one position, and get really entrenched in that. An example, a place that I see this kind of entrenchment is coaching family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he started 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. Another example, I'm doing a series of retreats with a good buddy and colleague of mine called What's Next Exec. And you can see an example of it if you're interested for any reason, whatsnextexec.com, no apostrophe. It's for current senior executives and CEOs and professionals who are within a year or so of retirement. It's designed to help them create an informed and masterful transition to their next contribution or career. Many of the executives we've seen at these retreats have been in corporate America for three decades or more, but want to retire to pursue things that they have passion about, their own business, consulting, coaching, another career. They've not had the experience, though, for example, of setting and collecting professional fees, of operating by creating their own structure. They've been surrounded and supported by a corporate structure, so their challenge is analogous to those of you who move from a paid position to opening your own coaching practices. You know much of what they're going through. They've never had to market their services, set up a PayPal account, establish a business name, or find somebody to do a website. So retired, basically, is not an identity. It's the lack of one. And many of the examples that I've used throughout and some of the principles I've sort of honed at this retreat and in working with these individuals who are passionate about developing something for their next career, their next contribution. So think about it in this way. What do clients want from us? The coach and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus the new in an evolving new story. We're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back to her out loud. We must be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or let our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What our clients want from us as coaches is analogous to the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we give it back to its creator as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of the internal perspective and best interest of the client. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become, and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, a behavior as an answer to a question that its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I stole that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it because I love it. An answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process. To validate their intuition. And, of course, to stick with ours so that we can. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in his process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, creating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and the most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. Probably the most, rather than one of the most. I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I've said to some clients, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Perhaps intervals of quarterly updates, or at least once a year, can be beneficial to both coach and clients. Booster shots, witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals. What we do with each client is not about being right, not about having pristine theory and technique, not even mutually idealizing achievement, but the bottom line always, does it work? Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. I believe Hemingway captured this principle when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, let's look at your important storylines. How exactly are you taking care of yourself? I'll ask clients how often they work out, and I'll gently nudge them if it's not 5 to 6 times per week. We're going to discuss your wellness story in just a moment. How are you honoring your needs and ideals? Your relationships? Have you created something that now seems to be controlling you? Or creating something that will leave a legacy? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you find things daily to be grateful for, to celebrate? The ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, actually initially to resonate empathically with the client, then to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, or to celebrate. I want to summarize and review 12 caveats of how we facilitate change in coaching. And again, this is all in your outline. I've distilled the following principles that focus on facilitating change in the coaching relationship. And especially, I think they're applicable to coaching about change and transition, which, of course, every coaching engagement is when you think about it. But we're talking also about the focused content of the client here. One, each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Two, understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which do not. Then, to change the ones that don't work, the ones that do work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. Three, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. And think about this. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Now, I stole that from an old codger colleague who was a counselor on my treatment team in the alcohol treatment unit back in the day, and he told me I could use it, and I have repeatedly because I love it. Four, distinguish what to change, accept, let go, and enhance. Placing energy into what works coupled with accepting and letting go of what can't be changed results in significant effectiveness. Five, when people create their own answers, they have signed on to invest in the outcome. Six, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain the old story. Remember, we talked about the fundamental aspect, the most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity, and someone will always return to their identity unless that evolves and changes with the changes they're making on the surface and behaviorally. Seven, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. So learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs, how they color what you perceive. In other words, a client is not going to think about their story as an old story. They're not even going to think about their story as a story. It's just the way things are. What you're doing is helping them to look at their story and then look at the elements that work and don't. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere both become visible. Eight, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. People are most successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. If someone is protesting change, they've already engaged it. Nine, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. For example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. 10. Solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to align the client's needs and values, to strategize toward the client's goal. the coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically pursue goals. 11. A collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side, looking at the same scene together. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make powerful coaching interventions. Remember, I've said repeatedly, state comes first, then strategy and story. Also, validation of what is positive will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. A comment is perceived as judgmental can result in a really defensive reaction. And 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't will become evident and self-perpetuating. And again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who has completed the 26th grade has forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated, that will be internalized of how they can work with their clients or their patients or their colleagues. Now, let's talk about your wellness story. And this is to each of you as well as for you, for your clients. A significant aspect of change and transition is to build in a new wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car. You'd probably change the oil more frequently. Do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car you had for the rest of your life, you'd probably take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. My wife has heard me say more than once, as some dish passes us at a restaurant, you know, I know I'm what I eat. I do not want to become that. Your wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. And wellness is an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it constantly has to be assessed. And especially when people are in change and transition, it's the story that is most commonly forgotten or omitted or relegated to the periphery. Wellness is not something you begin to plan at age 65 or even at 50. Every choice you make every day writes your wellness story. Here's an illustration of a little choice. Overall wellness is not based on the big monumental choice, but on little things. If you plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill but get off after 10, convince you're a little stiff today, it's one small choice. No big deal. No one has a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on the treadmill on one day. But you resolve to cut empty calories, and then grab a few peanut M&Ms from the candy bowl. Not really thinking about the choice, because no single M&M, not even five, causes anyone to have diabetes. You take in 100 calories more per day than you burn. In 1 year, you gain 9 pounds. There's also my next-to-last blog is on the importance of little things, and it's right along lines. I won't repeat any of it here, but I would suggest that you take a look at it while you're there looking at mantras. We're in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives more than anyone in all of biological time. So our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. Now, this evolution has taken a while because health is biologically more complex than disease. So let's talk for just a moment about the story that we engage with our bodies is one of two possibilities, experts tell us, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who's written a well-accepted perennial bestseller called Younger Next Year, and there's a version for women called Younger Next Year for Women. I had the opportunity to share a speaking experience with him, and we got familiar with each other's writing. And reading his book, I'll tell you how it's changed me in a second. What he says is that 70% of ADs dedicated over 30 years of his practice as an internist in New York City to wellness research, over 70% of aging is not aging but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically, as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. Another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. This alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. The new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Dr. Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of our lives is mandatory. He emphasizes that 4 of those 6 days of exercise need to be serious aerobic exercise for the rest of our lives. Biologically, our bodies only know 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that age and kill us. Mortality falls with exercise. Of 3,000 people surveyed, 3 activities stood out above all others that prompted procrastination. These are things that everyone knows exactly what to do. There's no question that people know what to do, but the things that they're most likely to know but not do, exercise, good nutrition, and save for retirement. Short-term desires trump long-term goals. Emotions usually rule. Now, consider this. On the other hand, showing up for work, projects, assignments, they're usually responded to routinely and promptly. This suggests that a task such as exercise be treated with the same mindset as work. With work, you don't have to get up every day and debate about whether you will or won't work, whether you'll take off a couple of days or just skip it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. You don't debate or consider yourself virtuous if you do decide to go. You don't bargain with yourself to say, well, I'll do it a little bit more next Tuesday. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. Exercise can be the same mindset. Now, for some, this is like a new job. It's a full commitment, a serious commitment. It requires a plan, just like your business. According to Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. Now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer, you're not a dietitian, you're not giving directives, but you can make informed recommendations, and then you can listen to how your client takes information and makes choices to write the next chapter. And you're always free to challenge the choices or the trail of logic leading to them, and to their fulfillment. With every new client, I will ask in the initial evaluation session, what kind of workout program do you have? What do you do for exercise? Now, 2 things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells. Enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's exactly what we do as coaches. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Remember, it's the part of the brain that a message goes to attach meaning, especially with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus in mice by almost 100%. And very recently, these studies have been replicated in non-invasive studies of humans in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells decrease, so it goes the other direction. So memory and creativity diminish. The Power of Story has another chapter created by studies of athletes taking human growth hormone and those taking a placebo. The group receiving the placebo believed they were getting human growth hormone and improved at 4 fitness tests measuring strength, endurance, power, and sprint capacity. This was written up in a study, as a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine. They reviewed, internists at Stanford reviewed 44 studies and concluded that it was really the belief and the mind that improved performance, not the drugs, the medication, or the human growth hormone, but the belief and the mindset that improve performance. Here's one example of an implication here in terms of looking and planning in terms of transition. This was a study done by Emily Pronin at Princeton. She found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money people put away to retirement, depends on how closely we identify with our future selves. When brain imaging was done, people who actively can visualize their future selves create a significantly greater amount of savings because it's aligned with what they see as their identity. And some studies on the West Coast have recently, in a consortium of places, has replicated the study by doing computer-enhanced aging to show what aging will do for different things, like for exercise, for diet, for smoking, for gaining weight. And they find that when people can actually see the changes that whatever behavior it is brings about, that it significantly enhances their decisions to do what will be in their best interest. So the conclusion of these studies was that encouraging people to imagine themselves in the future might help them look at better decisions. Now, your story hides in plain sight. Think about the differences of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. Now, contrast that to those who accomplish and believe a different story, and their lives embody that story for themselves and others. Their story within, their plot, guides them and orients them to a script they consciously write. So, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen. And that's what people are paying you money for, to illuminate and bring into sharp focus not just their stories and the manifest behavior, but to help them look at understanding that and in this present moment, looking at the choice architecture of creating what's going to be in their best interest. So it's waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapter of their life and business stories. So think about some of these questions. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would the title and subtitle be? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what will that be? Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? What events or process foreshadows your next success? What roles will be the most important? What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? What is your spiritual essence? Now remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. Now I want to look with you as we bring to a closure our formal discussion. I want to look at the life stages of success. So this is moving beyond the wide-angle lens. This is time-lapse photography. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life. In fact, at each developmental phase. And I want to give you a quote from each of these, because sometimes a quote can say way more than we could in elaborating things. Here's how it may look in a relationship. And this is from Ruby D, I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is by Wolfgang von Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth inevitably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve momentary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important. And here's the secret. Ideally, beforehand, and you'll achieve much more success and much earlier. What's really important? Your why. Your passion. A caveat. Be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. Now, here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective from one of my favorite essayists, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you to get in a very comfortable chair, in a very comfortable position, and be very relaxed, be very aware of how your chair is holding you. Take a couple of deep breaths to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. And be aware of your entire body being very relaxed. Close your eyes now. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge. What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now from that position, the future? For example, any turns or cautions or risks that you should have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face, your hands, your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And who's there with you? Remember, you always know more than you think. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in any thoughts or questions or things you'd like us to talk about.
Dave, this is Catherine. Hi. Do you have text under the life stages of success? Because I have.
You asked that again.
What you talked about, the life stages of success, is it in the transcript?
In the outline, I don't think it's in the outline. No.
Not in the outline, because I have a blank after the life stages of success.
Oh yeah. Yeah, okay. I hadn't decided in which one I was going to use, so no, it's not in the outline. I wouldn't know how to outline it still. But
all those questions that you asked would be relevant. Is there any way of getting
the final exercise that we just did?
No, what would be, or describe a story, what aspects of your story?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll be happy. Let me make a note. I'll send that to everyone. The questions, if your story is published in a book, that one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. I'll be happy to send that.
Thank you.
Sure. You bet.
Yeah. Dave, this is John in Colorado. I didn't get last week's course, class emailed to me. I didn't receive it.
Okay, let me clarify. Nobody gets anything emailed to them. When you signed up, there
mm-hmm.
was a link that goes to a page that has the link to download the outline and the...
Oh, all right.
And then there's the
okay.
playback on that page, and it's posted. This time it wasn't posted... I checked with the IT guy, and he posted it today. So the one now should be posted by noon tomorrow. So those will be there. Since this is CTA, they don't allow MP3 download, but it's for playback. So it's on that page, so you can catch up.
Cool. Yes.
CTA usually has a policy that those remain up to 30 days past the last day of class. So until November, 28th, probably.
Okay, good.
Yeah, okay, thanks for checking. Other things you'd like to talk about? We've got a few minutes. How did you find this? Was it what you expected? Did it help you in thinking about working with clients with change and transition, or even looking at specifically developing more of a niche in doing that? I'm interested in your experience.
Yeah, I did. Very helpful. very dramatic. Like I said last time, your stories were very impressive and memorable.
Okay. All right. Yeah, thanks for your comments. Other?
Well, yeah, this is Alfred from St. Louis. It helped me tremendously. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I plan on having a workshop and sharing this information with the community.
Ah, okay, great.
It also helped me find a niche. I mean, the niche I was thinking about, and as you mentioned, you know, all of our coaching is about change, but it definitely helped me with the niche. I was thinking about baby boomers, you know, and there's a lot of change in that field.
Uh-huh.
And then also people struggling with addictions, and you had mentioned in another session, you know, I was struggling how to present that without going into therapy, and I can see even after you come out of it, if you had been in therapy or any type of detox, that's a major change, and it's a lot of dynamics that go on in that change process that, if understood, would help people, you know, as they recover.
Absolutely, I think that people in recovery can very much use life coaching. And when you distinguish yourself from sponsor, counselor, therapist, mentor, and distinguish yourself as a coach, I think you can have a nice fit with that community and do a great deal of good, because I think you have unique skills to offer, and just be sure and distinguish what you do and what you don't do. And I think that can be a powerful application and a huge transition piece.
Yeah, it is.
Other thoughts or questions?
Hi there. It's Kathy in Toronto.
Welcome. Hey.
Hi. I think the course has been great. I don't know. I was thinking about this earlier, and I think someone else mentioned it. Just how successful is this with the elderly? Because I've tried to give, you know, I'm working towards becoming a coach, but just sort of, you know, before the designation, kind of having that, I've been trying to help some seniors with some of these transitions, and there seem to be an awful lot of blocks. A lot of this is, I've found, is kind of newer thinking, so to speak, than what they are used to. You know, I've heard seniors say, well, this is why I am the way I am, and, you know, people are born this way, and they grow up in this situation, and, you know, that kind of thing, and they sort of have a lot of, the seniors I've dealt with have had a lot of sort of limiting frames of reference, and the whole idea of meditating was really odd and scary. You know, they're used to praying, trying to explain, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of, this is frightening to them. This is like, oh, my gosh, I'm totally losing my foot.
And you're immediately dismissed as one of those weird woo-woo people.
Yeah, you know, are you going to hypnotize me and steal my purse? You know, I actually had a senior ask if someone could do that. And I, you know, she meant it seriously. She thought, is that what meditation is? And I said, no, you know. But, I mean, it's very hard because they're so entrenched often in where they are, and they have all the logical reasons why they're stuck, and this is how it is. And it, I don't know, do you have any advice for, other than just keeping to try?
I think you're, you know, a couple of things that I would think about. One is practical in terms of working with these people, and another is finding ways to work with them in terms of settings. One is to not do any direct challenging, but to tell stories that resonate with what they experience. And the stories illustrate things that will have to do with change and transition. Think about how fairy tales are used in children's books, that the fairy tales resonate with the kinds of experiences that children have. There may not be words or a language for, but they kind of resonate, and they see an evolution, and they kind of get into it, and then they see a resolution in some way, and then they can vicariously experience a mastery in doing that through a story. And I think when you think about working with people, I think working with everyone, story is huge. In fact, I just put up, because I had a number of requests, one of the first transitions, one of the first things I did formally, when I made my transition from practicing therapy, can I get a mute please, because there's a background noise. If you're on a cell phone or a computer phone especially.
I don't know if it's me in Toronto, but I'll mute just in case.
Okay. Thank you. What was to do a mentor training with a storytelling mentor, someone who I found immensely valuable. And this was just after I completed my coaching certification. And in fact, I had a number of requests. I put it on my resource, on the homepage of my website. There's a resources link that goes to it. And I have his name there. And he does some programs. And I think it's really useful to really understand and appreciate stories, because stories are how we understand, how we learn, how we remember things. And we can talk about, can I get a mute, please? There's still a cell phone that's creating some echo, if you don't mind, because I'd like to, I know we're out of time, but I think to tell stories that people can identify with and to engage in elements without somebody having to do it so directly. We used to do this back when I practiced therapy and analysis. I had one of the first two or three major eating disorder treatment programs in the country in a way that the young women who had eating disorder really got into an engaged position was we would do a mutual storytelling group and began by talking about, present a little scenario beginning of a story and then pass the talking stick. And then they would tell their own story, but once removed, and they could talk about it if it were in a story. This became the book Destiny that you'll see under my library. It's a way to get people in a non-threatening way to be able to participate and talk about their challenges and their issues and to engage in that way. In terms of working with these people, they're not going to pay you to change because that's the last thing they want to do. No, that's not the last thing. That's the never thing they want to do. So look at other ways of engaging other kinds of funding sources from institutions to organizations to children, their children, various kinds of ways. Look at who are the gatekeepers for this group and look at perhaps how you can coach the staff of a senior facility or develop a mentor program. I have a mentor program that I developed for organizations and companies to teach people how to become mentors. It's something you can do as a coach to help people become better coaches for their clients and facilitate what they do. So there are a lot of different levels that you can think about in that regard. Well, we're over time, and I apologize for that. Thank you very much for all of your input and energy. I really appreciate everything that you sent and responded, the questions. I hope that I've answered your questions. I hope I've raised some other ones that you're still going to be in the process of answering. But I hope this has been stimulating and useful for you. It's been a privilege to work with you, and I hope we have ongoing contact in the future. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.